welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode number 222 of the podcast, and it's 22nd of June 2015 as I record this. That's a lot of twos, maybe that makes it a lucky day or something. But today I'm actually answering some of your questions from the Creative Pen survey, and it was really amazing to do a survey and seriously have about 2,000 questions. So today I've picked a few that I thought were interesting, talking about self-doubt, what defines a good book, discipline and habits, ideal genres, editing and time spent on marketing, many of which are some of the very common questions I get asked. So hopefully you'll find today useful, and it will mostly be my voice that you hear in this episode. Back to interviews next week. But first, in the publishing world, it's been a pretty big week, actually. The big news has been Amazon KDP's change to using Pages Read for KDP Select Kindle Unlimited borrows, rather than just books downloaded as such. I personally think this is brilliant. I know there's a lot of sort of ups and downs about it, but I think we've seen a lot of kind of scammers join KU because of the sort of ability to get as soon as people download the book and it's a 10% read, you get the money. And I mean, I've seen a whole load, and I hate the tsunami of crap conversation, and I have it a lot. I know many of you do as well. I believe that most indies constantly produce great work, great books with brilliant covers and, you know, very well worth reading. But when people kind of drag down the reputation by producing crap encouraged by KU, then it has sort of had an adverse effect on many of us. I also realise that some people have done well in the last year with KU. So, I hope that doesn't sound too negative, but I really do think that this is a good thing. Amazon have also introduced machine learning for book reviews this week. So some big changes going on. And I think in general, the principles are still always the same, which is write a good book that your audience will like, whether that is a, you know, if it's a short story, then fair enough. If it's a novella, fair enough. If it's a novel, fair enough. But write something that your audience will love. Don't focus on whatever the latest technical kind of possibility is, but write things that will work for the long term, that will please your readers. And then it doesn't matter what the technology does. You will always be able to reach people with your words and carry on writing. And I personally think that's exciting, because that's what we love to do. We love to write, we love to create books that our readers will love. So, you know, to be fair, I think these changes are only positive. Also, we have a development from Apple this week, which I think is excellent. iBooks now allows you the ability to use pre-orders up to a year before a book's release date without needing any finished assets, which means cover or book file. All you need is basic metadata. So all you need to do is put up a title, author, book description, and even those you can change prior to release. So essentially, up to a year before you put a book out, you can put up those books for pre-order on Apple, either through publishing on iBooks Direct, as I do, or you can use this facility through Smashwords and presumably Drafter Digital as well. And the reason why this is exciting on Apple is because you get the pre-orders on the days that it hits, but you also get all the pre-orders into day one sales. So you often can hit the bestseller charts on iBooks based on accumulated orders. So if you think about that, you can spend a year before your book comes out promoting it and getting pre-orders on iBooks. And then on day one, on release day, when it goes live, you get all those sales. So I'm pretty excited about this. And It will also encourage people to think a longer term. So I'm thinking, for example, my Arcane series, I definitely have Destroyer of Worlds, which will be coming later this year, and probably One Day in Prague. My One Day series of novellas are super fun and gives me an opportunity to go and do a research trip to each of the places I write about. So One Day in Prague, obviously I'll need to go to Prague. I might even do One Day in Amsterdam because I quite fancy a couple of days there. Anyway, so really exciting big week in publishing news. In terms of my week, what's so funny about doing this weekly podcast now is I'm looking at my intros and going, oh goodness, I really have to achieve something every week in order that I can tell you about it on a Monday. This is quite good for me, and I think this regular accountability is excellent. So what else? So I finished the edits on Deviants and sent them off to Jen, my editor, so now waiting for that to come back from Jen. That finishes the London Psychic trilogy. I have left it open though. So if you enjoy Jamie and Blake, the potential is to continue with either of the characters or both of the characters, in fact. There is a trilogy that sort of rounds up with that book. So that's exciting. I've also been doing a lot of businessy stuff, accounting, taxes. I had to finish my company tax year. But that's actually quite fun for me because I get to see the growth in the business, and I have some hopefully exciting things coming up that I can't talk about now, but will do in coming weeks. I've also been working through Mark Dawson's Facebook course, which is amazing. And again, if you listen to the interview with Mark a couple of weeks ago, Mark Dawson, I sound quite skeptical in that interview. It's really funny how my attitude has really turned around because I've tried these things now and I'm just kind of like, wow, this is good. So if you are somebody who has, I think it's only for people who have more than one book, and if you know who your target audience is and you know who your similar authors are, you know, you have to be, I think, quite developed, and you also have to have a budget for paid marketing. So it's certainly not for everyone, but if you're interested, the course is it's open today. It closes today, Monday 22nd of June 2015. But equally, if you're listening later, I've kind of asked for an evergreen version, so hopefully you can go and have a look anyway. thecreativepen.com/Facebook, that will take you to Mark's course, and hopefully it'll be open when you check that out. So definitely for people who have more than one book and a budget for putting in paid marketing, but I'm definitely getting crazy value from it and putting that into my own marketing strategy. Bit more on marketing. If words like autoresponder and audience segmentation don't make you crazy, go and check out the self-publishing podcast, episode 162, on selling more books with autoresponders. Actually a brilliant episode. Now, I know many of you listening will love the guys over at SPP. Some of you may have listened and decided it's not for you, but whoever you are, I do recommend SPP episode 162, selfpublishingpodcast.com. On autoresponders, again, really, really useful about audience segmentation. All of these things, I think, represent, the Facebook marketing and audience segmentation, this type of thing. This is very mature marketing type of stuff. And I think it's a kind of signal that the indie movement as such is becoming more mature in general. And we're picking up these ways of doing things from very developed internet niches. I think it's only a really good thing. And I know some of you listening will be like, I'm writing my first book, for goodness sake, I don't want to know about that. That's fine. But just realize that when you're ready, there are people for you to learn from. And that's what I love about being indie. We just share stuff. We share what is working and what's going on. And you'll always be able to find the latest thing and what's working from, hopefully, from shows like this and SPP and from courses and things. Okay, so our new regular segment, which is, what are you doing while listening to the show? Which actually I'm still really liking. So Kathy emailed and sent a picture of her walking her dog by the Missouri River, which was really flooded. So that was cool. Jeremy spelt Gerimi, which is an awesome way to spell Jeremy, and I'm tempted to use the name in a book, Jeremy. But Jeremy sent a time-lapse video of him drawing, which was amazing. Alison says she's working on her author platform while listening. Anita is listening while driving to the day job near Chicago O'Hare Airport, and sent me a photo of the freeway, which actually made me really laugh because. And you're about the third person to send me a picture of the freeway. But what is brilliant about this, and I hope you guys are finding this useful, audio is just booming. And people like Anita listening on the freeway, this is evidence of, you know, how audio in cars is going to be so important. You know, when, and you know, I've talked before about Google Auto and Apple CarPlay streaming audio in cars from 2016. Very exciting. Adam says he's listening from the beautiful state of Tasmania, walking the Launceston flood levee to and from work, and sent me some beautiful pictures of Tasmania in Australia, which is an amazing place. And although I've been to every other Australian state, I never went to Tasmania, to Tassie, and I actually have on my list of ambition to dive the kelp forests there in Tasmania. So if you're into scuba diving, Google the kelp forests in Tasmania and you'll see what I mean. It's quite kind of similar to Monterey in California. Very cool. Anthony St. Clair says, what I'm doing, I'm updating the profit and loss statement for my books. That's very organised, Anthony. Excellent stuff. Louise is on the rowing machine, and Carolina has sent a picture of the beautiful patchwork blanket she's making while listening to the Creative Pen, which I love because I can't sew for toffee, so or for chocolate or for anything, actually. I think that is brilliant. Lindy is out for a walk, and what else? Yes, and also Parker suggested a related idea. Where will you be listening when you're earning mega amazing income as an author entrepreneur, which is a nice spin. So anyway, I'm always looking for feedback on topics as well as where you are listening when you listen to the show. So tweet me at the Creative Pen with a double N on Twitter, or email joanna@thecreativepen.com. Okay, this podcast episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I will play a word from our sponsor in a minute. And this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and the transcription, because we have transcriptions on the show now. But my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys, so a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. On Patreon, you can support me with a few dollars or even just $1 per show, which is only for two shows a month, so less than a coffee a month. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen, or you can buy my books. Thank you so much. Okay, here's a word from our sponsor, and then we'll get right into the Q&A.
Hi, this is Mark Lefebvre. I'm the director of self-publishing and author relations for Kobo, and we are very, very excited to be a sponsor of the Creative Pen podcast. Something I wanted to share with Creative Pen listeners is the fact that via Kobo Writing Life, you can set your book to free at any time for as long as you want. There's no exclusivity requests. I would advise authors, though, who are looking to set their book to free, to think about it as part of a strategy. What is your goal to set it for free? Are you looking for more readers? Are you trying to garner reviews? Or are you using this as a funnel to get people into your catalog? Come to KoboWritingLife.com, where we discuss such things, and check out the Kobo Writing Life podcast, which is also linkable from the blog. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn of the Creative Pen podcast.
Okay, so today we're doing something a little bit different. I did a survey on thecreativepen.com recently and had a couple of thousand responses, and there were lots of questions. There were sort of three or four questions on each thing. So I have a lot of questions from readers and listeners of the Creative Pen site, and today I'm starting a new series of answering questions. So I know Steve Scott, for example, has a daily show answering self-publishing questions, and lots of people do that on individual shows, but I'm just going to do occasional shows where I answer your questions.
in between the interviews, not every month or anything, just kind of oddly. But this is the first one. And what's so great about getting questions, I think, is that partly it's really good for me to reflect on my own process and also to realize how things have changed in my own life, I guess, after years now of doing this. So this is quite fun. So let's get on with it and I will read the question and then I'll answer each one. Okay, so a question that came up quite often is, how do I know I wrote something worth reading? How do I know that my book is good enough? This is a great question because I think it's even worse for indies. I mean, in the past with gatekeepers, essentially, you would know you'd written something worth reading because an agent and a publisher picked it up. So you could at least say, well, you know, it must be worth reading because they bought it. And then even if you never sold any books, you can say, well, somebody thought it was worth reading. So that's brilliant. But if you are an indie, then my answer is, first of all, you might never ever feel that your book is good enough. And I say that now, and I've just finished the second draft of book number 16 or something. And I think there will always be self-doubt. I talk to quite a lot of creatives, obviously a lot of my friends are creatives, and I've read a lot of books, and even, you know, people like Stephen Pressfield, who's in his 60s and written loads of books and super successful, people still have self-doubt. I just think that is the life of being a creative. So first of all, know that you may never feel that your book is good enough. Secondly, get an editor and make it the best it can be. And for me, I have, you know, over the years, I've had a number of different editors. With the first fiction book in particular, I actually used about 5 different people because I, you know, had a manuscript critique, I had a structural review, I had a line edit, I had another line edit, I had a proofread, and I paid a lot more money for that first novel than I do now, because I became a better writer. And the fact is, unless you are paying professionals to help you, I don't believe you can get better. I mean, you can read all the books you want on self-editing or how to edit and that type of thing, but you actually need other eyes on your work. And those eyes, in my opinion, should be professionals. If you have a critique group full of people who haven't been published or haven't finished a book, what good is their opinion, really? In my opinion, you should have a professional read your book and help you make it better. I have a list, if you're interested, at thecreativepen.com/editors, and that will help you with editing. The third thing is, just get on and publish it, and you will soon find out in the reviews. This might be a little bit hardcore, especially if it's your first book, but many people seem to do it with kind of confidence. In this way, if you end up having loads of 1 or 2 star reviews, you can just unpublish and then go back, you know, delete it, get rid of that, do some rewrites and start again. And if it does really well, then super duper, that's brilliant. So those are my tips for, you know, how do you know your book is good enough and making it better in general. It's actually a related question about why can so many indie books sell so well? So I think this is related because the definition of good and good enough is totally subjective. So the question from this person is, why can so many indie books sell so well despite poor story structure, dialogue, etc.? My friends who read traditional books refuse to consider indie books because they are poorly written for the most part. What really matters? And the question there is, what really matters, story or, what really matters in general, I suppose. But in terms of why can so many indie books sell so well, or let's just say, why do some books sell better than others? Because let's face it, in Britain we have this, you know, one of these sort of, in America I think it's the snooky example, you know, traditional publishing publishes all of these famous author, you know, famous people who just get a ghostwritten book, and to be fair, the books are pretty awful. And traditional publishing is responsible for publishing a lot of crap. So let's not blame that on indie books. The second thing is, in terms of poor story structure, dialogue, etc., when you talk about the friends who read traditional books refusing indie, this is just pure snobbery, basically. Most people who shop on Amazon, for example, and Kobo and iBooks, don't look at the publisher. So most people will not even know who published the books. But in terms of why do some books sell so well, let's use the example of E.L. James' 50 Shades of Grey, which many people, well, let's say most people would not consider great literature. But it actually has a good story and it has emotional resonance. And that's the thing, that emotional resonance is usually the reason why books sell so well. You can have a lot of literary fiction which is incredibly well written with, you know, beautiful language and perfect structure, but it doesn't emotionally connect with the masses. So I really dislike the word good. You know, what is a good book? That's absolutely up to the reader. Some readers will want to read, Amish romance. But and there's a couple of indies who do Amish romance and sell really well. Some readers will prefer, you know, Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch, and that for them is a good book. Many people bought The Goldfinch and didn't read it. So I just want to encourage you to consider really that a good book is considered good in the eyes of the reader, not you or literary critics or anything. And what the indie world has enabled is it's really shown publishers what readers want to read, not rather than what they want to give readers. So 50 Shades is a great example. It was self-published and then it did so well that it got picked up for a deal and then did even better. And it would not have got picked up for a deal unless it had shown publishers that it was popular, that it was a good book in terms of being a moneymaker. So I hope that helps you. You know, basically, in order to have a book that sells well, the main thing is really to connect with readers on an emotional level. This is something I am trying to learn myself. I'm definitely from a literary background. My mum was an English literature teacher. I went to Oxford and everything was very much about literary fiction, and it took me a long, long, long time to write a thriller because I was stuck in that kind of groove of thinking that only literary fiction matters. But the most popular books are not literary fiction, they are emotionally resonant genre fiction. So that is your challenge. You can, of course, write a well-written, emotionally resonant book, and that is what I hope for. Okay, next question. How do I discipline myself to sit down and write every day? This is one of those evergreen questions, and there's a couple of ways to unpack this. First of all, why do you have to write every day? That would be my first question. And what is your definition of success, you know, back to you? So, for example, I write something every day, as in emails or something in my journal or whatever, but I don't write fiction or non-fiction every day. I tend to have first draft binge periods, so I will spend some time researching whatever I'm doing, and during that research time there won't be words written in the document as such. There will be research words written, but not actual draft words. Then when I'm ready, I will sit down and attempt a period where I do write every day, or at least 5 days a week. And in that period, I get the first draft done. So for me, I'm now in the middle of June. I've just spent the last week or two not writing anything new, but editing the work that I had written. So I'm not writing every day as such, but I'm working on my business every day. Or at least have a day off on Sunday. Although I say that, it is Sunday as I'm recording this. So that's the first bit. Do you really need to write every day? The main thing is to actually make a plan for what you want to achieve. So let's say you want to write your first novel in a year, within a year. I think that is a good framework. And then you would say, okay, well, I'm going to allow myself a couple of months to research how to write a novel, do lots of research on my topics around my book, think about characters, blah, blah, blah. But on April the 1st, I am going to start writing the first draft. April, May, June, I'm going to finish the first draft. Then I'm going to start the editing process. That would be a way to do it. So actually, you only write every day within that period. Then the word discipline. I find this a difficult word, as I think many of us do. I actually think a better word is to think about habits. So, for example, now, in order to get my first draft done, I go down the road to cafe, plug in rain on repeat. Yes, I listen to rain and thunderstorms, and spend a couple of hours in the cafe writing my first words. So the habit is to go to the cafe when I'm at, you know, within this particular cafe in the morning between about 7 and 8 and 10 a.m., I write words. And that's all I do there. I don't check the internet. I don't do emails. I don't write anything by hand. I just type words into my computer. So that is more of a habit than a discipline. I also think discipline, it sounds more like you're forcing it. And although you do need to use some force to start a new habit, I think that for writing, if you're not enjoying this, I mean, seriously, why would you do it? You have to enjoy some of it. Otherwise, do something else with your life. I mean, I spent so long doing a job I hated, I can't imagine now doing something that I don't enjoy. So obviously there are hard days, and this is what my friend Alastair Humphreys calls type 1 fun versus type 2 fun. So type 1 fun is, you know, having a drink with friends or going to a party or something that is obviously fun. Type 2 fun is difficult at the time, but it's fun when you look back on it, which I think is mostly what writing is. So how do I discipline myself to sit down and write every day? I hope that answers that question. It's more about your definition of success, the deadlines you set, when you're going to write, and how you make a habit to do something that you ultimately enjoy. Okay, how do you find your ideal genre as a writer, artistically and or as a business question? I think this is about what you read. So when I thought about writing a novel, I immediately thought, I'm going to write an action adventure thriller because that's what I read. I don't think you can write in a genre unless you read in it. I mean, you can start writing in a new genre, but spend a lot of time, you know, read a couple of hundred books in that genre. I mean, over my lifetime, and I'm 40, I have read thousands of thrillers. I mean, seriously, thousands of thrillers. I am a thriller addict. I love the escape aspect. I love all the kind of foreign places, and I love the vicarious excitement of thrillers. So for me, I was always going to write what I read. I also read a lot of self-help and wanted to be Tony Robbins, so hence my self-help books for authors. So for me, the ideal genre as a writer is what you like to read, because then you know your audience, you understand the conventions of the genre, and you'll love what you do. This is why I don't write romance. I mean, I have a romantic element to my thrillers, and I have sexual tension and that type of thing. But for me, the romance genre is not something I read. So even though it might make better business sense to write romance, I respect the romance writers enough to know that I'm not writing them. I mean, I'm not writing it off forever, but I really think it's important to respect your readers and write in genres you know. So that was a quicker answer. Oh, and there's a follow-on question that from somebody else that was similar. Should I pay attention to those that say to write what is sold in great quantity, or do I write what is my passion? So this is, you know, similar question. Again, romance sells in great quantity, memoir doesn't, but many people write a memoir because it's their passion, and also because writing a book teaches them something, changes their own life, it is a creative expression. You know, basically, I think at least all of us have certain books that we have to write. So for me, that book was Career Change. That was my first book. And certainly Desecration was, you know, one of my novels, was very much a sort of book I really wanted to write. You know, you have to pay attention to the creative muse. But equally, if you want to make a living from this, you do have to do some research around quantity. So hopefully that helps that. So really, again, it's always about what is your definition of success? Do you want to, you know, write about your you're in history, you write a memoir, or write something that will help you work out your own issues, or do you want to write for readers in order to make a living? So that will really impact what you write, how you market, how you publish. Next question. How do I write and publish quickly while working a full-time job and having some kind of life? Can a person have it all? This is a great question. And my short answer is, no, you can't have it all. Or at least not at the same time, as the quote goes. So, how do I write and publish quickly while working a full-time job? I don't know how you can. When I had a full-time job, I used to get up every morning at 5 a.m. and write before I went to work. I also worked in the evenings and the weekends. But I was learning, I mean, certainly when you first start writing, you have to learn all of this stuff. So I would write creatively in the morning, and then I would work on my blog, and I would learn about, you know, actually learn the craft of writing. I did classes, all that kind of thing. So while I was working a full-time job and the money was being paid by the job, I was very much focusing on the craft side and not writing and publishing quickly. I was actually learning how to do this new thing. I didn't actually have much of a life because I was working all the time and then, you know, on my job and then writing as well, it was very difficult. So, you know, we saw friends sort of on a Saturday or whatever, but I did cancel quite a lot of things in my life because I was very determined to change my own career and become a full-time blogger, author, speaker. So I don't think you can do it at the same time. Once you understand how to write a book, which is a task in itself, and how to publish, then yes, that's when you can speed up. But I would think that you then have to swap out some time from your full-time job or your life in order to do that. So we all have the same amount of time, but you have to decide what you want. Again, definition of success. Next question. What is a good process to use to edit my fiction book? I keep going back over the entire manuscript from start to finish. I've gone through it 8 times already and I see no end. Each time I find issues that need to be rewritten. They can be a few issues with grammar, but mainly are places I believe I should rewrite and improve. Basically, yeah, this will always happen. If you read any book, you will find something you want to edit. Definitely, you need to get an editor. If it's your first book, there will always be things you could rewrite over and over and over again. But you have to draw a line in the sand. This person also says, it is difficult for me to spend several $1,000s only to end up with a book that might only sell a dozen copies. So basically saying the cost of a professional editor is too much and may not be justified by income. Well, this is the point. What do you want for this book? Do you want to be able to get this book printed and say, this is the best book I could have possibly written, and, you know, I've put some money into it? Because basically people put money into hobbies. This doesn't have to make money. And most self-publishers, most authors don't make money. That's the truth of it. So think about any other hobby you have. Maybe you ride bikes, maybe you do knitting, maybe you do photography, maybe you have a gym membership. I mean, think about what people spend on a gym membership in a year. It's like $1,000. It is in London anyway. I mean, you have to consider what money you would normally spend on hobbies or eating out or other things like that. If you spent that money on an editor, so you have a professional book and you actually learn the lessons of writing a novel or nonfiction book, then that will help you move forward. So I absolutely think that everybody should save up the money for their first edit. You know, I paid out, let's face it, the first couple of years I did this, 3.5 years I worked part-time, and then going part-time so that I could leave my job. And the money was put into the business before the money started coming out of the business. And that's true of any type of business. We're very lucky with being authors that the money we put in is very small. I ran a scuba diving company in New Zealand, and we had a boat, and the price of fuel and, you know, employees and dive gear and food. I mean, It's crazy how much money some businesses take up. Okay, so hopefully that answers that question. Another question here, what are the things you should never scrimp on? And I'm sure you're now going to guess that I would say editing is the thing you should never scrimp on, followed closely by book cover design. Those are the two things I believe you should pay money for. They are the two things I pay money for and pretty much nothing else. What to do after the first book is finished, or what should I do after the first book is finished? The answer here is start the next book, because one book will never be enough. Or if you don't want to write a book, then you probably are not, you don't want to be an author. That's not your thing. For me, as soon as I finished the first book, I was like, right, I'm desperate to write another book and another one and another one. I love writing books. It's like an addiction. So I think if you feel that, then awesome, get on with writing more books. If you don't, then obviously get an editor, start editing, look at the publishing process. But certainly you should be thinking about what you want to do with it next. And also thinking about marketing, but again, most of us find that one book is not really enough to make a big enough income. So marketing just with one book can be quite frustrating. But you could look at things like BookBub once you have some reviews on it, that type of thing. Okay, this question, how can we answer the question, who is your publisher, without allowing the person to make us feel somehow inferior? It seems the less people know about the publishing industry, the more they think they know. I usually end up saying the name of my publishing company, which I own, or I launch into an extended explanation of my research and subsequent decision to pursue self-publishing. There must be a better way. This is a great question. Obviously, lots of people say, well, who's your publisher? But mostly those are other authors or writers, and it really means absolutely nothing. So there are a couple of ways. One is to say, so who's your favourite author? You know, ask them, who is your favourite author? And let's say they say Stephen King. And then you say, well, who publishes Stephen King? And they are likely to say, I don't know. thus proving that the name of the publisher is completely pointless. So that's one thing. The second one is to say, do you listen to indie music? Do you watch indie films? Do you buy things from Etsy or from, do you drink craft beer from, small batch breweries, that type of thing. Turn it, or do you buy vegetables at the farmer's market? And then say, well, you know, that's why I now sell my own books, because readers like to buy directly from the artist, don't they? And that kind of, again, reframes the idea of self-publishing from something that's a sort of negative to a positive, indie-minded way. And most people now will have bought from Etsy, or they will have listened to indie music or watched a film, that type of thing. That's what I do anyway. Next question. How much time do I spend on marketing? Oh, these questions just have so much in there. They're awesome. But this is different depending on where you are with your career, and also, once again, your definition of success. So obviously the person is asking how much time I spend on marketing in terms of asking how much time they should spend on marketing. So the first thing is, what is your definition of success? Because you only need to spend time on marketing if sales are important to you. I come across a lot of people who are just kind of mindlessly doing marketing things and spending money on marketing or time blogging or doing stuff. And then when you actually say, well, you know, what is your end game? Is your end game to leave your job and become a full-time author? Many people say no. You know, is your end game to become a professional speaker, in which case it's very important to you to have an online profile? And they might say, well, no. So really, you have to look at what what do you want the end point to be? If you do want to become a full-time author, for example, then realistically, the marketing, in inverted commas, you need to be doing is writing a lot of books within a popular genre, having professional editing, professional cover design, and building an email list and all of that type of thing. Much of that time is spent on writing rather than things like building a Twitter following, for example. I am a confusing person because half of my income is from book sales, and I only started writing fiction after I had been running the Creative Pen for a couple of years. So my original business model was non-fiction and professional speaking. Now it's combined between 50% fiction sales, book sales, and the other half, non-fiction book sales, speaking fees, affiliate income based on the blog and the podcast sponsorship. So if you want to have a non-fiction book, speaking career, podcasts that pays you money, that type of thing, then sure, do what I do, which is blogging, podcasting, social media, all of that type of thing. And very much for nonfiction, that's brilliant. If you are writing high volume fiction, many people who do that and make really good money only write lots of books and build an email list, and they have maybe one social media account that they use to connect with readers. So you have to really decide what you want to do. Now, in terms of how much time I spend on marketing, every day I make sure I create something new in the world, but I also, every day I focus on my business. Now, that focusing on my business may include podcasts like this, which is both marketing, you could say, but also income driven because my podcast is sponsored. I also do emails, which again you could consider marketing, as well as accounting and publishing tasks and all of that type of thing. So I would say also marketing is things like designing book covers and doing your back blurb, that type of thing. It might be going to events, but there isn't really an exact split. So let's take Twitter for an example. I love Twitter, and it's my social life as well as a marketing channel for the Creative Pen. I would go on Twitter even if I didn't have a business. So is that marketing, and how do I measure that over time? So there is no exact split. You've got to decide what your definition of success is, decide what your business goals are, and what are the best ways to meet those goals. And this is something I think I've learned a lot in the last year, and writing Business for Authors, How to Be an Author Entrepreneur, really helped me. There's a section in there on strategy, and strategy is what you do and also what you don't do. This is very important. Too many people are running around doing, when actually what you don't do is also important. So, you know, for example, I don't go to a writer's critique group. That's not something I want to spend my time doing. I do go to events, meetups with other entrepreneurially minded authors. I don't do physical book signings, for example, but I do schedule content on Twitter. So you have to decide what you want to do with your time and what works for you, and focus on that. So a related question, how do I determine a return on investment for my time? Do I spend the time to write guest posts for my upcoming book launch or work on the next book? I realise they are not mutually exclusive, but the larger question is a methodology to balance marketing versus creation. Okay, so that is pretty much related to what I just said. Every day, create something new. That would be my number one rule. That creating something new may be a podcast like this, and that is still marketing, but working towards things that you can sell. If your goal is to make a living as an author, you should be either writing words, doing research on the next book, researching your niche, that type of thing. So you, in terms of return on investment, it is very difficult to measure exactly, obviously, but you have, return on investment is very much related to income. So what income do you get for the time that you spend? Guest posts, for example, can be very, very good for nonfiction. I think they're completely useless for fiction, as somebody who's done it for both. So I don't do guest posts anymore. really for fiction or nonfiction. I mainly do podcasts because I think the guest posting market is overheated, but podcasting is still, even though it's grown massively, it's still easier to stand out. So for my time, it's easier for me to spend half an hour on a podcast than come up with writing in yet another article on something repetitive that may or may not get any traffic. So this is difficult, but again, you have to determine your own ROI. But for me, it's always about creating first. So if we look at what I did today, this morning I got up and I finished the edits on Deviant, my next book in the London Psychic series, finishing a trilogy. So editing that was the first priority, because by finishing that and sending it to my editor, I've made a very big tick in the book towards getting another product out of the door. I've done emails, which are running the business and slash marketing, and now I'm recording a podcast, which again is income related, but also marketing and helping people, which is intrinsically rewarding. So those are some of the things, and it's more about you finding your own balance, but set your goals and deadlines. So for example, if you've said, I'm going to finish my book in the next 3 months, if you don't hit that target, you really have to stop doing the other things. So maybe you spent an hour a night on Facebook when you should have been writing. So setting deadlines can really help you with everything we're talking about, because in that way you can really measure what you're doing and what you're not doing. I've also got a day book now, which is really handy. This is something I learned from Austin Kleon, who wrote Share Your Work. I've got a Moleskine, but obviously you can use whatever type you like. It has one page per day for the whole year. And in the day book, I write down what I do on the day. So, obviously you might have day job or childcare, but also you can write down 500 words, or I've written down here, finished Deviant edits, sent to editor. Oh, I've also prepared my slides for a talk I'm doing next weekend at Brit Mums. And obviously now I will be writing down recorded podcast questions. So I can already see today I've achieved three things. One of which very much relates to the bottom line, or two of which really, and also marketing activities. So that's, I guess, some things that could potentially help you. Okay, and the last question I'm going to do here, is there a place I can get training in the business side of things? My very short answer here is that I've written a book called Business for Authors, How to Be an Author Entrepreneur. That is available in ebook, print, and audio. And I actually narrated the audio, and you can get that on Audible, Amazon, iTunes, and Kobo, and iBooks, and Nook, and all the rest. So, yes, you can get training in the business side of being an author, and that book is a good place to start. All right. That it will be the end of the questions. I hope you found that useful. You can tweet me at The Creative Pen or email me, joanna@thecreativepen, and let me know if you found that useful, and I'll definitely do some more. Happy writing week.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.